The Scouted podcast is brought to you with the support of our friends at Skill Corner, whose tracking data and performance analytics are used by many of the top clubs, leagues, and federations around the world. Covering a wide range of global competitions, Skill Corner's data helps customers to make faster, better informed decisions in recruitment, player development, and strategy. And we are now using it to support our own analysis of up and coming talent. For more information, visit skillcorner.com. Hello, welcome back to the Scouted podcast, powered by our friends and data partners at Skill Corner. As always, I'm your host, Joe Donoghue, taking you through the various topics, leagues, stories, and insights from the world of scouting, recruitment, and youth football across the globe. Today, we have another expert guest joining me on the pod. Stuart Mayers, most recently technical director at DC United in MLS, is alongside me to discuss his journey in the game, as well as what it's like to undertake the various analytical and football business roles he's performed throughout his career. I'm sure there'll be plenty of interesting anecdotes to share as well, Stuart. Welcome to the Scouted Pod. How are you doing?
Yeah, great, Joe. Thanks for having me. Excited to chat. Little bit of a different kind of role for me right now, but I'm looking forward to it, and appreciate you taking the time to speak with me.
No, of course. I mean, I introduced you there as being most recently the technical director at DC. You spent 7 years there. What was that like, just sort of in a nutshell, you know, going from, you know, your previous roles to then, I mean, 7 years is a long time. You must have, you know, picked up a lot of skills and sort of little niches and nooks and crannies that you like to work within.
Yeah, I think, first of all, you know, very lucky really to be in that role for so long. I think in this day and age of, you know, the volatility of the game, I think I've had a pretty good stint there. I think, you know, from start to finish, it's been an experience. I think for me, you know, the hands-on nature which the club kind of allowed me to kind of flourish in certain instances and make mistakes in others, I think I'd always be, you know, appreciative of. And I think, you know, it's allowed me to gain that understanding of the role and have a wide range of experiences, good and bad, to kind of get to where I am today, which is, you know, I've probably seen most things now in terms of what can happen inside of a football club. So, you know, for me, starting off, coming pretty much new into the role, around about 7 years ago, it wasn't really too much of a job description for me. It was, you know, I've been working for Prozone for a long, long time, you know, I think almost 15 years. It was a blank canvas, really. You know, DC had, historically a very, very successful club, a very, you know, big club in the kind of the stratosphere of MLS. But I think it was around putting a little bit more structure, a little bit more process, having more kind of a look to the future and getting more on board with some of the more kind of, advanced processes using data, video, etc., and widening that niche of trying to bring in players and staff that could propel the club forward. The league as it is today is completely different from the one that, you know, I kind of joined, you know, 7 years ago. It's getting exponentially bigger and a really exciting league to be in. And it's improving at a rapid kind of rate of knots. So you don't really kind of quite understand how difficult the league is to maneuver in this type of role until you're actually in it. And I think, you know, past sporting directors, technical directors in Europe have kind of come and gone and found it really much more difficult than they've ever imagined. So I think it's a really good place if you can get into it to kind of ply your trade. And, you know, I feel very lucky that I've had that experience in order to get 7 years out of it, to be fair.
You touched on there that, you know, you worked for Prozone for around 15 years. And for anybody who isn't familiar with Prozone, that was sort of the company that was at the forefront of data use in elite football, sort of in the early to mid 2000s. You've worked alongside or at least worked for the company at the same time as some names that fans of big clubs will be very familiar with. You know, the likes of Michael Edwards, who obviously has made his name with Liverpool, and you know, the Lee Darnbrus, Darren Mowbrays, who are obviously holding positions at reputable clubs nowadays. What was it like working with Prozone? Did it feel as though you were caught sort of on the cusp of something really important? And, you know, could you have seen how integral data and the use of video would become, 15 years down the line, as you say?
Yeah, I think in a nutshell, yeah. I think, again, very lucky to kind of be in that kind of cohort. I think Michael Edwards was at Portsmouth at the time. You know, guys like Simon Wilson, Lee Dormer, as you say, were still rocking and rolling and pretty big roles at their clubs. Prozone itself was way before its time. You know, I think back in the day, and you know, they were doing some things that were really advanced for what kind of probably the game was ready for. And it just so happened, again, you talk about the kind of the Man United class of the Nevilles, Beckhams, you know, Scholeses. It was, you know, there were some pretty really good people who knew what they were doing and were really kind of invested in, you know, improving the craft. And, you know, even guys like, you know, Paul Nielsen, who's now, you know, general manager at Skill Corner, or Blake Worcester, 21st Club, you know, these guys were, Barry McNeil now with Bloom Sports, you know, Barry was my boss at Prozone, you know, 20 years ago, and I still connect with him, and we still discuss the industry now. So I think, again, just guys that were really tuned in, you know, had a really kind of thirst and growth mindset, and I think you can see that right now with the positions, as I said, that they're in. But well before its time, it was hard work and it was a lot of work. I remember, you know, when I first joined Prozone, we were, you know, on, I think it was Round Here Road above a laundrette, and you know, there was two rooms. One was a production room and one was kind of the business development room. You know, one of the lads had a taxi, you know, a taxi company by night, so you know, he'd be able to pick up all the lads, you know, that went around Leeds, and after a night out, and they come in, and the following morning they'd all be, you know, those production guys were all working on games from the following day. So just a lot of kind of hands-on hard work to get to that stage where, you know, Prozone really was a really, really good company to work for with really good people. And I think I really cherished those days. It was unlike anything else, where very rarely do you get to the opportunity to learn from a group of people that are of a similar mindset from you and have that thirst for growth. And all those guys did it. I can't remember really anyone who hasn't from that group gone on to be quite successful in what they want to do.
Absolutely. I mean, the list of names is exhaustive. That's for sure. We touched as well on MLS as a league and you know how it's changed over the years, certainly over the 7 years that you were technical director at DC United. And it was something that caught my eye in our scouting newsletter, Scout Notes, a couple of months ago now. And it was, you know, the fact that Major League Soccer is changing. And I think that it's the same with these things all the time. Perception always changes after the fact. You know, it's the perception among casual football fans is that, you know, MLS has always been a safe haven for aging stars that, you know, want a bit of a change of pace from the intensity of European football. But, you know, you look at the likes of Inter Miami now, you look at the shift in momentum and the shift in emphasis towards up and coming talent, particularly from South America. You know, is that something that, I mean, you were trying to get ahead of the game on when you were at DC?
Yeah, I think so. I think, I'd kind of preface that by saying I think when I first joined, the teams were, you know, MLS is still kind of wants to be built on a league of parity, whereby if you are, you know, a fan of DC United or San Jose, even if you've had a bad season, at the beginning of next season, you've always got a fresh chance and you've got a chance of winning the league. Which I think probably when I first started was true. There were, you know, a number of different teams that won the league within a space of time. You know, the teams were relatively balanced. And, you know, the Beckham effect with the DPs had just started to kind of come into the league. Now, you know, it's not really good enough to be a millionaire. You have to be a billionaire in terms of to invest in MLS. I think nowadays you just look at the value of some of these franchises now. You know, I think LAFC have broken, you know, the $1 billion valuation for franchises. You know, the franchise fee, I think, for, you know, San Diego is somewhere around $500 million. So, you know, you have to be the same billionaires now, really, to be really competitive in MLS. And, you know, I think there are still a lot of marginal gains that certainly on the playing field you can you can pick up on. I think, you know, the scouting kind of departments within MLS, you know, some do that very well, others not too well. I actually did a study before I left, and I think you know, the average MLS team, I think, has around if you take out technical directors and any kind of directors of actual scouts, have around 2 domestic scouts and 3 international scouts. But the average kind of skews that a little bit. As I say, probably half the league, you know, may only have 1/2 scouts, and they, you know, will be involved in the data collection, the data analyst, and as well as the video analyst as well. So, you know, I think there's still an area of improvement that can go on within MLS in terms of putting good product on the field, given the salary cap restrictions. You know, one of the things that we tried to do quite early on was use our data as effectively as we could, you know, within the realms of our budget. A couple of years, I think we did that quite well. I think, you know, we took, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure. I think we did that quite effectively and gained a reputation of that in terms of actually, you know, squeezing more longevity out of some of the players that maybe were undervalued. But as the league has progressed and the ownerships have progressed and these new franchises have come in, I think it's really hard for teams that are, you know, that don't really have that, you know, collateral to go on and spend big, because ultimately now, you know, you're going to be able to have 3 designated players. You're going to be able to have 3 players that are under 22 that are unlimited transfers. And Miami, to be fair to them, have done that very, very well. They have 3 big DP players, and I think they've just paid an average of maybe $5 to $7 million for 322 players. And suddenly, you go from to having real top players, and the proof is in the pudding with where they are right now. So I think, you know, as the league expands and the owners that want to spend money have more of a say within the league, you know, that's only going to continue in terms of the big players coming and being a league of choice for MLS. And with the World Cup coming up also, the league needs to show itself that it's ready to compete on the world stage. And I firmly believe that MLS is, you know, a top 10 league. You know, you have coaches. You know, we had Wayne Rooney in last year, and obviously he's coached in the championship and League One and played. And, you know, I think one of the big things that you know, European guys coming into this league, they don't realize how difficult it is. I mean, you know, you can get on a train, hop on a train, and, you know, go 4 hours and, you know, back and forth to a game in the UK. That would be in the US. You know, it takes you 4 days to play in Vancouver by the time you've traveled, played, come back. So it's really difficult. It's a completely different animal, and that's what makes it, I think, so exciting, MLS, is that, you know, anyone can still beat anyone, but the balance of kind of power is shifting a little bit to the teams that are willing to kind of spend a little bit more.
You're talking about working with Wayne Rooney there, of course, and, you know, you were technical director when he initially came over to the States in was it 2018 that he came over to DC United, and then, of course, you know, between 22 and 23, he was the head coach for you guys. And you know, with such a high profile figure, what was the feeling around, you know, being able to get someone of that stature, that standing within the European game over to MLS? You know, was it kind of like a, I mean, I know nothing's going to compare to sort of the Beckham moment, but was it something similar on the, you know, in terms of the notoriety scale, so to speak?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, first of all, it was a really exciting time for DC United as a player when he was here, and also as a coach. I think, you know, when he played for DC, he was fantastic. He just, you know, exactly the same guy as what you've seen in terms of, you know, on the television. You know, very passionate, wants to win, trained every day, always wanted to do more. Was really good in terms of the younger guys. I remember, you know, for 6 months in one season, I can't remember which season it was, it might have been 18-19 probably, where we had him and Luciano Acosta, and teams just couldn't handle them. You know, the plan was just to defend and then get the ball to those two and they'd win us the game. And for 6 months in MLS, we were fantastic. You know, we averaged, I think, 2.4 points per game in the second half of the year, one loss in like 20. And we were pretty good. And, you know, obviously then Wayne left and Lucio had a chance to go to PSG, which was real. And, you know, he was going to take Neymar's place and that kind of didn't work. And, you know, obviously he came back and then, you know, that kind of dissipated. And I think we hit really a really good, exciting spot in the trajectory of the team and the organization. And then, you know, as a coach, obviously I think Wayne coached how, you know, he would want to have been coached, you know, very people's guy, you know, very aware of the players and their mentalities and the culture in terms of, you know, having them right to play and looking after them. I think, you know, that was probably his strongest suit. You know, he's having guys who were on board and wanting to play. I think, you know, obviously it didn't work out in the end at DC, you know, for him. But, you know, I think one thing that you just pick up on is just his vision of the game. Like you're in meetings and, you know, you've got the video open, the analysis opened. You know, I think in one instance, you know, we were talking about the players, like what ball should you have played there and how can you have done that better? You know, he stopped, said, I stopped the meeting and said, I would have played this ball. And it was like, nobody in our team would have ever thought to play that ball. It's just the way he thinks so far ahead and sees the game, and it's just like, you know, you're Wayne Rooney, like you're probably the only person on the planet who can play that ball. But I think he was very kind of, he was very happy to let the players express themselves. He wanted them to play with freedom and try things. And, you know, I think it was probably at a stage where MLS, where we didn't really have the group. We didn't really have the group of players that probably how we wanted to play. We weren't good enough. But also, you know, we were still in that phase of, you know, we were in the three managers, I think, in more or less 2 years, which was rare for DC because they'd had a manager previously for 10 years without changing. So the team was also a little bit in flux in terms of, you know, from a previous manager who wanted to be high press. You know, final third where Wim was very much kind of build out of the black back, play with a high goalkeeper. Your goalkeeper is, you know, you're almost like a sweeper keeper. And, you know, I think, you know, he tried to stamp his authority on the group. And, you know, I think a combination of different things made it quite difficult. But I think, you know, having that experience, certainly in MLS, will stand him pretty well. And no doubt he'll be back in the game sooner rather than later.
Of course, I mean, I have to ask, you know, having worked in close quarters with somebody who is, you know, such a, you know, household name in the game, What were some of the sort of the best anecdotes that you have of working with Wayne Rooney at your time with DC? Because you know it's you know you get an image or you get a picture of how certain people are from their dealings with the media, but there's always a sense that they're holding something back or they're maybe not being their truest self. They're very media trained, so to speak. You know, what behind the curtain of you know the offices in DC, or you know the WhatsApp conversations, or all those sorts of things. Is there anything that you're at liberty to share about what Wayne was actually like to work with?
Very relaxed, very very normal. I was from Preston also. I'm from Preston, so he was born and raised in Cropstith, I think. So I remember the first time that I met him. And we were training at RFK Stadium. It was 90 degrees. It was a blazing hot sun. And he was basically doing he was kind of a medical, but he was outside. The team was playing away from home and I stayed back and just to meet and greet and whatever. And it was blazing, sunburn all over and blah, blah, blah. And he was really blowing. I'm pretty much thinking, you know, what have I let myself into here? It's so much hotter than, you know, it's ridiculous. We were back in the changing room and, you know, he's looking at some of the analysis on the wall and, you know, I introduced myself and he said, you know, what's going on? Where are you from? And I said, you know, I'm from Preston. And the first thing he was like, no, I'm sorry to hear that. Tapping at my like, I was like, okay, like, we're going to get on not too badly here. But I think for me, just he's really normal. Like he's not. You know, you could have a chat like this and he'd be absolutely, you know, on board with everything you say. You know, I think one of the things that you know, he's obviously just passionate about the game. And, you know, he's intense when he needs to be intense. But, you know, I think when he was on the field, you know, he didn't really show any of that, to be fair. It was very much more giving the freedom to the players that to express themselves, how he wanted to probably, you know, be coached also. You know, just you know, as I say, I'd got on really well with him. I didn't really have any, you know, I was always quite upfront with him and honest with him, and we always had good chats. And you know, I remember one time whereby we were playing, I think, in an Open Cup game. It was a league game against New England. And actually, I think it was Matt Turner just went absolutely straight through him and he got a red card in. And he actually, I think he broke one of his ribs or he cracked his shoulder or both in that game. And we were playing a pretty important game the following week. And he had a broken rib for sure. And we had an Open Cup game against, I can't even remember what it was. It might have been like Flower City or somebody that, you know, from like the seventh or eighth tier of the Open Cup. It was ridiculous. And he was like, I want to play. I was like, you're not playing in that game. It's like, just relax, like chill out. Like, no, I want to play. It's like, dude, you got a broken rib, like just take your time. Like we got a 3-day road trip, like in like the weekend. Just don't worry about it. He was like, no, I want to play. And I want to say he was on the bench for that game, but he trained every day. He trained every day that week with a broken rib. As if nothing had happened. Still, you know, left, right, smacking him, top corner. And I think actually the manager probably pulled him out and sat him and said, you're not playing, but. Just again, just that wanting to play, I think it was a, you know, that release for him that you know, he just wanted to play and make the most out of it. And, you know, just a really, really special, special player, even then. You know, you could just tell, oh, this guy's just ridiculous in terms of some of the stuff that he could do. You know, he had everything, like strong, smart, could strike the ball. You know, he had that aggression, could run in behind, you know, really smart movement, like, you know, just little subtle fakes and dips of his shoulder whereby he'd separate yourself from the forwards. I think he scored maybe 3 goals from about 40 yards out. Just like just like kicking the ball off the ground further than I could kick it out of my hands, just belting balls. And I bet he scored maybe 3 goals from 40 yards out, like from dead balls and open play. Like, obviously, you've got the famous one where, you know, the smallest guy on the field ends up, you know, Lucio in from the header. But I think he scored probably like, must have scored 2 or 3 goals from more or less the same spot. And it was just really ridiculous. You were always in with a chance when you had somebody like him. And that's really the best kind of anecdote that probably I could make of him, is that you were always in the game when he was on the field. From any situation, he could score or assist from anywhere. And really good player, just a top player to have in your team.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Wayne Rooney's his tenure as player and coach during your time is obviously a big topic, but as well, sort of, we were talking about the you know, in your role, there's also the sort of the transfer element and the squad building element as well, and basically analysing players at other clubs in different leagues, who could you know, bring something to the table for you guys. And I mean, when you look at some of the business that was done during your time there, I mean, there's a lot of players from South America, or at least a handful of them, a lot of them from different leagues. You know, I'm thinking Ulises Segura from the Costa Rican Premier Division, you know, Yamil Assad and Lucas Rodriguez on loan from Argentina. I mean, Luciano Acosta being the big one, of course. Junior Moreno coming from, I think, was it Zulia in Venezuela or Colombia?
Yeah.
You know, in your role, how difficult is it when you're sort of assessing these different leagues and trying to see, okay, how much of an equivalent is the Venezuelan Premier Division to MLS? And, you know, how can I judge this player based on, you know, his attributes and his exploits in one division and basically supplant or transplant him theoretically into an MLS outfit?
Well, I think you've seen a lot of clubs from the Premier League and Europe do that now with MLS. You know, MLS is a landing spot for a lot of these younger South Americans, like guys like Almiron, for example, prime example. You know, really, really good player. Like, was fantastic in MLS, and it took him a little bit of while. And now you've seen him at Newcastle. I mean, really dynamic player. I think, you know, first and foremost, there's always players that can play. I think there are thousands of players that are in South America that could play, you know, in Europe, certainly in MLS. You know, you go and watch, you know, Boca or River's third team. I mean, some of the players are ridiculous. I think the styles of play are always, you know, interesting to see. And obviously, you know, if you're a high pressing team and, you know, a Red Bull type organization that wants your forwards to press, you know, you're probably going to skip some of the Latin American teams, because it's very much, you know, possession based, skill on the ball, you know, a lower tempo but a higher skill level. There are certain leagues in South America that are super athletic. You know, the Brazilian league is super athletic. You know, I think, and, but, you know, there's a premium tax on Brazilian players because the Brazilian players. I always love to go and watch games from Uruguay. I think there's some top players there in Uruguay at the younger level that are affordable. They have the bite, they have the fight. You know, it's a population of, I think, you know, 3 million people, and they all grow up in a small area, you know, living and dying by playing football. And you see now some of those players, like Uruguay, the national team, like, you know, fantastic, you know, really some really, really good high quality players. So I think, you know, when you base all of that in there in terms of, you know, the stylistic aspect, you know, guys that are humble and hardworking and have the right culture and the right attitude, you know, I think it's still a really, really good, you know, grounds for scouting. I mean, I'll give you one example. Caicedo, who, you know, was at Chelsea and was at Brighton before that. You know, Caicedo was on the discovery list of MLS teams 4 years ago, maybe longer. Mm. You know, so a lot of these players, because there is so much scouting going on now in South America, most teams have a scout in Argentina, just because it's Buenos Aires and it's, you know, it's close to Uruguay. You can go north, south, you know, hop over to Chile if you want, hop over to Uruguay, you know, 30-minute flight. You know, most teams, MLS teams now have scouts on the ground there. And I think, you know, part of my role now, what I'm doing is kind of trying to, you know, broker that gap between those European teams that maybe don't have or are a little bit reluctant to dip into South America, because let's face it, it's too far away. And you need guys on the ground there to really that you trust and know. But I think that's part of what I'm trying to help those teams with in terms of, you know, a little bit of kind of a rundown on those players. And, you know, family background is important. Most of these players in South America, you know, their parents are involved. You know, they'll want compensating. You know, it's a tough sell for a lot of these players to get out, especially in some countries, which, you know, again are economically crippled. You know, in terms of just the different countries at the moment. So, I think, you know, I think the translation to a lot of these players is soccer wise or football wise is quite easy. It's just spending the time to and having the patience to have them adapt and acclimatize. You know, we've had players where we've done that, whereby, you know, we had a player, a Venezuelan player, Giovanni Bolivar, who we signed from Venezuela. We brought him into our DC and we loaned him down to our second team. And he was great, but, you know, he didn't really want to learn any of the language. Very, very talented boy. And he came in January when there was still snowing and things like that. And he just couldn't handle it. And I think he's gone now to Albacete or somewhere else. And he's now playing for under-21s Venezuela. He's in a language, in a country that he can speak Spanish. And some guys just, you know, some guys you just need to, a lot of the guys you just need to put in the right environment. And it's not the soccer part that is the problem. It's embedded them into the right kind of dynamics where they can flourish. It's still a hotbed. There's still players in South America that you can tap into. And as I say, moving those into MLS first, whereby, you know, English speaking country, you know, the training methods are a little bit better. The facilities are a lot better, you know, and having 1 or 2 years in MLS and then kind of moving on, I think you'll find will become more prevalent, especially with the under 22 initiative in MLS, which encourages, you know, teams to spend on younger players and develop them. You know, MLS is still, you know, a selling league, but I think there's a lot more kind of respect for the league now because of the players that have come from, you know, particularly South American countries.
Just staying on the topic of sort of player trading and that sort of thing, you know, we had a preliminary chat before we recorded this, and, you know, you were saying that in your role or the roles that you've held, you know, timing is everything. And it's, you know, it's often a misconception that, you know, when you want to recruit or you want to squad build, it's, you know, it's scouting is one thing and recruitment is another. Like, it's not a video game. It's not a game of Football Manager where, you know, you don't really have to take into account the human aspects of a transfer, the human elements of you know, upping sticks from South America and coming to DC and, you know, being in the snow, for example, as you've just said. You know, how difficult is the element of player trading and translating, you know, being able to translate talent ID into effective recruitment, into, you know, actual performances on the pitch? It just seems as though there's a lot of steps to get that right, to get it, to make it really successful.
Yeah, and I think what heightens that is that, you know, MLS is a global league now. You know, it's a global league. You know, there's no Brexit. You know, there's nothing to preclude any real nationality from entering into MLS and being a part of that ecosystem. I think the last time I checked, there were 80 different nationalities playing in MLS. So, you know, you generally have to scout everywhere, or you try and scout everywhere. I think the trick to that is, as you say, you know, identifying some of those leagues that are pretty similar to, you know, the way that MLS is played. I always really like to watch, you know, France League 2. I think it's, you know, just the dynamic, the transitional play in that league, the athleticism, you know, and some of the kind of the raw talent. It's a quite similar league, I think. If you're watching a French League Two game, you think, yeah, you know, an average French League Two game and an average MLS game, there's not you know, too dissimilar patterns of play. You know, the difficult one is obviously trying to compare, you know, with like I said, the Championship with MLS. And teams, you know, I think there's still quite a lot of snobbery in terms of, you know, oh, it's MLS and these teams would be League One. I mean, the top teams in MLS wouldn't be in League One. I think, you know, they'd be pushing certainly at the top of the Championship. You watch a Championship game and you pretty much know before you go to that game what you're going to get. I think MLS is similar, but there's a little bit more variance in the technical quality. I think some of the individuals that have been brought in, and again, what you would actively scout for. I mean, we always try to have almost like a process at the end of each year in terms of what are some of the trends and what makes a successful team in MLS, and what are the stylistic kind of things that work in MLS. Because, you know, you can pretty much have two plans, I think, the way you kind of, from an organizational standpoint, you can be really organized, have a set system of play, a Red Bull type model, whereby that's probably the best thing about the Red Bull kind of model is they know exactly what they're going to scout for, what players are going to fit. They have certain markers that they hit, and if they don't hit those markers, they don't sign the player. That's one thing. That's one way of doing it. And, you know, the other way is, you know, you find a niche, you know, a niche metric, a niche style, a niche player, and you essentially overuse that style and you overuse that plan and strategy until somebody finds it out, and then you try and find another strategy to, you know, and then you rinse and repeat. So I think there's a variance of that within MLS, where some are very teams are very, very structured in terms of the way that they operate. And I think ultimately, you know, that sustainable type and model is going to be more effective long term. But then you recruit towards that, right? I think, you know, there are always certain positions in MLS that are going to be more important than others. Most of the teams still spend their money high up the field, you know, in terms of forwards, you know, number 10s. You know, MLS is probably the one of the only leagues in the world that still plays with the classic number 10. And you can find them a lot in Argentina, which is why those players are more sought after. So, and again, if you go to Boca's second division, second team, and have a look at the number 10, they can probably play in MLS. So I think that's where that kind of, not only niche kind of player profiling and player positioning, it's also niche competitions in terms of where, you know, if you've had a good spell in recruiting from a certain South American country, you know, the bias is you're probably more likely to go and recruit from that because you've had success there before. And that can be positive, but it also can be negative. I remember when I first came in, there was a lot of that from Sweden, because Swedish contracts run out. They play the calendar year in terms of the way their league is structured. So most of the contracts run out at the end of the year. And so there was a huge influx of Swedish players into the league, and everybody thinks, well, why am I? Well, he's signing a Swedish player, so, and he was good, so we're going to do that as well. And, you know, after 2 years of doing that, you know, I wasn't ever one for signing Swedish players. I think it's a league that is probably, probably third in terms of Denmark, Norway, Sweden. I much prefer, you know, I think the Norwegian kind of league in terms of that. It's a lot more similar to MLS than Denmark and Sweden. But, you know, there's these patterns in MLS that kind of you're kind of drawn towards, which, you know, again, if you don't have that stability in terms of what you're looking for and that plan in terms of what you need to recruit to, you can get drawn into that. And some teams still do it. And you can, like I say, you can hit a certain one and you rinse and repeat it. But I think now that there's still such a spectrum in terms of the different departments of where you can gain an advantage in MLS. Like, some teams are very kind of have a really good medical department. Others not so much. You know, others have a very strong scouting department, but a quite a weak medical department. And, you know, that's the whole kind of beauty of MLS, is that there are always some, you know, competitive advantage that you can pick up on. It's just finding them and then believing them and then doubling down on them to try and make those work.
Just before we finish, Stuart, I'd like to sort of go back into your background and more or less your future as well. You know, somebody who, you know, you've had offers since leaving DC United at the end of last year. You know, you've had offers from England, you've had offers from Europe, to go into, you know, a similar sort of role, you know, directors of football roles, technical directors, whichever moniker clubs decide to use. As somebody with your background, with your experience, particularly on the data side of things, you know, how important is a project that when you are being approached by clubs, how important is it that they pitch themselves to you as well as the other way around?
Yeah, I think it's very important. I think, you know, I've been lucky enough to gain, you know, a lot of experience, you know, on the front line. And I think for me, certainly, you know, the project is important. I think, you know, it's in any kind of interview process, you know, in my opinion, I think, with the skill set that certainly I've kind of built up, it's finding that right fit for myself as well as the club that's interviewing. I think everybody essentially is at different stages of their cycle in terms of where they are as a club. In most cases, clubs are looking to recruit because they're looking to change. And I think it's important to realize and the underlying factors of why they want to change. You know, I think certainly that the role of a sporting director or technical director or whatever you want to call it, you know, manifests itself differently in any club. Like, some clubs really need that you know, transactional kind of leadership, whereby it's, this is what we're doing, this is what needs to change, and we're going to change it. You know, if you're looking to go into maybe building a club, a new franchise, it's maybe more of a collaborative, you know, leadership trait, whereby, you know, it's important to let everybody have a voice and everybody have opinion, and then, you know, make a decision based on that. So I think for me, you know, some of the roles that I've been fortunate to be offered, you know, have been really interesting. And, you know, the last one was not necessarily from a sporting perspective, it was more from a family perspective. But I think certainly, in my position, you're looking to kind of invest more in the project rather than the club itself. Like, is that project one that has a growth mindset? Does it align with some of the values that you have in terms of wanting to excel in certain departments? Are you going to be you know, valued and given the opportunity to steer the ship? I think those are important, because the organizational setup and the organizational design is crucial. And for me, it's one whereby you know, I think the game is so volatile, and it's understandable why I think there's so much hiring, firing, and I just think that the whole emphasis on the sporting director role is one where, you know, you can add some balance. You can add balance to whatever is going on within your organization. And I think, you know, the opportunities, I think, will arise now whereby there are a lot more instances whereby people that have a much more diverse skill set in terms of, you know, how they've, you know, their leadership styles, you know, empathy, all these things whereby they've had to endure in different sports, and the crossover in different sports, I think, is going to be more kind of prevalent in high level sporting director role, because I think the ability to kind of manage the ship and steer the ship is going to be ultimately long term, what drives, you know, sustainability and success. And my roles have always been kind of general. I would classify myself as a general specialist. Like my work at university was in sports science. I did, you know, a biomechanics degree. I've gone into, sports science roles within, third party companies. You know, I've been out in the Middle East and I've been the operational manager, general manager, working as operations at US Soccer, and I've been an analyst. So for me, it's one where I think anybody who's wanting to get into that role as a sporting director, I think the opportunity to gain as much experience as you can in all those different departments, I think you will set you up really well in the future. And, you know, as much time that you can get front facing and being in front of people and being in an organization that actually you can affect change, I think is important. I read something the other day whereby, somebody said that, straight out of university, here's a job for working at a lower league club, and they turned it down because now I want to work for Man United. Well, you're not going to work for Man United, straight out of university. So the opportunity to get experience at your local team or anywhere like that and really provide and deliver value add, I think is the best way to kind of get into this industry. And for me, I've always had I've never really had anyone to kind of lean on. I've always had to kind of really do it myself, and whether it's been in the Middle East on my own, in the US on my own. So, I don't think there's many people that get that opportunity, but at the same time, I've had to kind of fail and rework myself and do things slightly differently. But I think, the overall kind of, that overall, path that I've gone on, it's helped me to really enjoy what I'm doing now, which is, broken relationships, connecting people, having all these little touch points where I can, affect change from a individual consultant point of view. So I'm really enjoying what I'm doing at the moment, whilst not having that kind of, pressure. I think everybody in that environment has to have pressure. They love to be pressurized at the 3 points on a weekend. But I think for me, it's really kind of being targeted in where I want to work. And because I've got all these kind of different relations and different experiences, I think I can really add value to different, to different companies and different organizations that require different skill sets. And I would encourage anyone to do the same, any opportunity to get in the front line and diversify, because there'll always be opportunities there that you can translate to a role as a sporting director.
Well, finally then, speaking of sort of relationships and tapping into contacts and everything, just thought I'd give you the opportunity to say, if there are clubs, agents, scouts, analysts, companies, anybody who might be listening to this who is within the industry, whether they'd be interested in getting in touch with you, Stuart, where they'd be able to find you.
Yeah, sure. I think the best outlet for me is on LinkedIn. I think, I think for me, I'm more than happy to speak to anyone kind of rising up in the industry who wants my help and advice. I've got a lot to be thankful for in terms of people that have helped me along the way. And as I say, I'm on LinkedIn, and you can tap me up there and send me a message, and I'm more than happy to converse on all things soccer and everything that's mad about this industry.
Certainly is very mad. Thank you very much, Stuart, for giving up your time. I certainly hope that anybody who has listened, whether they be at the beginnings of their sort of career going into the industry, or somebody who's vastly experienced like Stuart, you've gained something from today's episode. I certainly know I have. As Stuart says, if you want to get in touch with him, do try and find him on LinkedIn. We'll be posting the correct spelling of Stuart's name and everything on in the description of this episode. You'll be able to go and find him through that. But Stuart, thank you very much for joining us on the Scouted Pod. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Really enjoyed it. Cheers.
Right, well, that's everything from the Scouted Podcast this week. We'll be back with another similar episode later this month. In the meantime, take care and bye for now. We'll be right back. The Scouted podcast is brought to you with the support of our friends at Skill Corner, whose tracking data and performance analytics are used by many of the top clubs, leagues, and federations around the world. Covering a wide range of global competitions, Skill Corner's data helps customers to make faster, better informed decisions in recruitment, player development, and strategy. And we are now using it to support our own analysis of up-and-coming talent. For more information, visit skillcorner.com.